was not the right person to offer it. I failed to consider the local assets that already existed in this slum, assets that included small amounts of money, a church, a pastor, and the social bonds of the 100 refugees attending the small business class. The truth is that there was more than enough time to walk back to the church, where the small business class was still assembled, and ask the participants what they could do to help Grace. While the refugees were extremely poor, they could have mustered the 8 cents per person to pay for the penicillin. In short, by providing the $8, I violated the 4 key elements of ABCD mentioned above. Of course, handing over the money was so much easier and so much faster than asking the refugees to assist Grace, and therein resides the problem of many poverty alleviation efforts. The North American need for speed undermines the slow process needed for lasting and effective long-run development. Why does all of this matter? Grace desperately needed relationships in the community in general, and in St. Luke's Church in particular. Her former way of life had created many enemies, and being infected with HIV, Grace was going to need solid support structures as time wore on. In fact, Grace needed to have her poverty of community alleviated if she was going to have any chance for long-term survival. Neither Elizabeth nor I could provide this for Grace over the long haul. I was soon leaving the country, and Elizabeth did not live in this slum. Grace needed the members of the community and of St. Luke's Church to embrace her and to consider her as one of their own. By giving the $8 myself, I missed an opportunity to facilitate such relationships between Grace and the local support structures that were crucial to her long-term survival. But I may have done harm to more than just Grace. My failure to identify and mobilize local assets may have hindered the development of those assets. For example, St. Luke's was a poor church struggling to minister in a poor community. My $8 removed a chance for St. Luke's to be what the Bible calls it to be, the body, bride, and fullness of Jesus Christ in this slum. I denied St. Luke's the chance to declare the good news of the kingdom of God in word and in deed to the least of these. Instead of helping St. Luke's to be salt and light, I joined decades of North American evangelicals in communicating that the Mzungu, the powerful, rich, educated white person, was the salt and light. And what about the pastor of St. Luke's Church? Imagine being this pastor, preaching faithfully week in and week out to small crowds and earning a highly uncertain salary. And then one day the circus comes to town in the form of a 6-foot-10-inch Mzungu with a compelling small business training curriculum. The small business classes drew bigger crowds than your Sunday morning worship services, and news is traveling that the demons are even being cast out in these classes. And then, when the newest member of your church, an ex-witch doctor, gets sick, the Mzungu, ringleader of the circus, pays for her to get the medicine she needs. In fact, by the time you learn that Grace was sick, she has already recovered. And then the Mzungu ringleader gets on an airplane, leaving you in the dust as you pursue the day-in and day-out grind of ministry. I may have undermined the pastor of St. Luke's Church. I did not realize it at the time, and I did not intend to do this, but I may have done so nonetheless. Finally, there were the refugees themselves. Their eyes had grown wide and their faces had brightened throughout the small business course. The message of the gospel was so freeing and empowering to them. For the first time, they understood that they were created in the image of God and had inherent value and worth. Even if others saw them as being from an inferior tribe, the Creator of heaven and earth did not see them this way. They had gifts and abilities and could be stewards over their lives and communities, and in doing so, they could glorify God Himself. Except, of course, that the first time a problem arose, how to minister to grace, the Mzungu took it upon himself to solve the problem, undermining every message that had been taught in the course. Oh, to have that $8 back! I wish I had encouraged Elizabeth to go back to St. Luke's to ask the refugees to assist Grace. Elizabeth could have brought the pastor in as part of the problem-solving process. While they were doing this, I should have gotten in the taxi and gotten out of there as fast as possible. Why? My entire presence in this situation, given all that it means to be a Mzungu, was completely debilitating of local assets, be they be human, financial, social, or spiritual. But what if the refugees or the pastor had failed to respond while I was driving away? What then would have become of Grace? I highly doubt this would have happened, but if it had, Elizabeth had $8 from her own ministry to spend. I am absolutely sure Elizabeth would have stepped in with her own money if she had needed to do so, and she was less of an outsider than I. My jumping in the taxi without providing financial help would not have put Grace at immediate risk. In contrast, my giving the $8, bringing in outside resources too quickly, missed opportunities for greater impact and may have done harm. The point here is not that outside resources are always a bad idea. Indeed, North American Christians need to be giving more, not less money, to help the poor. But how that money is given and to whom it is given is crucial. We need to look for ways to give money that builds up local organizations and that truly empowers the poor. My $8 gift failed to meet this standard. Common approaches to ABCD. The remainder of this chapter reviews three common approaches to ABCD. Asset mapping. Made popular by John Kretzmann and John McKnight of the Asset-Based Community Development Institute at Northwestern University, asset mapping has become a common approach to community development work in the United States. A better term for this approach might be asset inventorying, since the strategy primarily uses individual or group-based interviews to catalog the assets in a particular community. Prepared worksheets are used to document the assets in various categories, such as the abilities and resources of local individuals, businesses, associations, and institutions. Once local assets are mapped, that is, a comprehensive inventory has been prepared, community residents and facilitators can identify strengths, make linkages between existing individuals and groups, and determine the best ways to leverage these assets to improve the community and to solve problems. Although this all sounds rather mechanical, this approach has potential power as a starting point for developing empowering relationships. I learned this firsthand when I participated in an asset mapping exercise as part of a Sunday school class on community development at my church. During the Sunday school hour, our class visited a low-income housing project with which we wanted to develop a relationship. Each member of the class individually went door to door saying to people, "Hello, I am from Community Presbyterian Church, the church just around the corner. We are conducting the survey today to find out what gifts God has placed in this community. What skills and abilities do you have?" The truth is that I wanted to die. Racial tensions are still very present in our city, so I knew there would be at least some social discomfort for both the African-American residents of this housing project and for me. Furthermore, my height can be quite startling and intimidating, adding awkwardness to virtually all first encounters. And finally, the words I was supposed to repeat sounded totally hokey to me. "Hello, I am from Community Presbyterian Church, the church just..." Yuck! I would rather be selling Girl Scout cookies. I had a bad attitude about this exercise, and wished I had chosen to attend the Sunday school class that was examining the finer points of Presbyterianism. But alas, I had chosen this class. So off I dutifully marched and knocked on the first door. The 30-something African-American woman who cracked open the door slightly was about 5'2", giving her a wonderful view of my belly. She looked up at me the way one would look at one's first sight of a Martian. I tried not to flinch and launched into my sales pitch. Hello, I am from Community Presbyterian Church. The church, she said. What? Looking even more incredulous than before. I knew she was thinking to herself, the Martian can talk, but he sure says weird things. I swallowed hard and repeated. What skills do you have? What are you good at doing? She repeated, what? And then I repeated my questions again, asking God to add jewels to my crown for going through all of this. Getting past her incredulousness at the entire situation, the lady said sheepishly, well, I guess I can cook. Suddenly, a voice from the dark unknown behind the lady shouted out, she can cook chitlins like there's no tomorrow. Another voice yelled, yeah, ain't nobody can cook as good as she can. Suddenly, a smile spread across her face as she said, yes, I think I can cook. Next thing I knew, I found myself sitting in the living room with about 6 African Americans gathered around. I live in the South. This does not happen easily. Not sure what to do, I reverted to script. Hello, I'm from Community Presbyterian Church. They took it from there. This is Joe. He can fix bikes. Whenever one of the kids in the project has a bike that needs fixing, Joe is the man. A smile spread across Joe's face. And this here is Mac. How's your car running? If you ever have trouble with your car, bring it right here to Mac. I noticed that Mac started to sit up a little straighter in his chair. They went on and on, bragging about one another to me. All I had to do was sit there and write it all down. Yes, we got an inventory of people's assets that day, an inventory that we later used to help the residents dream about how to solve some of their problems. But more importantly, we started a process of empowerment by asking a simple question. What gifts do you have? When one is feeling marginalized, such a question can be nothing short of revolutionary. Participatory Learning and Action. Participatory Learning and Action, PLA, is a mindset and an associated set of tools developed by community development workers in the majority world during the 1990s. PLA uses a variety of group-based exercises to engage and energize community members in thinking about their community's history, assets, survival strategies, and goals. The processes are designed to affirm the community's members' knowledge and skills in order to empower them to take greater ownership of their futures. There are a wide range of PLA exercises, including timelines, seasonal calendars, community mapping, matrix rankings, etc. Although originally designed for use in rural communities in the majority world, PLA exercises can be adopted to the North American context and may be particularly effective with populations accustomed to community-based decision-making, such as immigrants, Native Americans, African Americans, and Hispanics. Appreciative Inquiry. Similar to asset mapping and PLA, Appreciative Inquiry, AI, focuses on what is right and good in a community's past as a means of creating a more positive future. based on a postmodern perspective that says that humans construct their own reality, AI argues that we should facilitate a process in which poor communities narrate what has worked well for them in the past. Once the community has constructed this positive understanding of its history, it can then use this narration to imagine how life can be even better in the future. Central to AI is the belief that people have more confidence to face an unknown future if they are bringing forward positive elements of their past. Christians need to reject a fundamental assumption of AI. Truth is not socially constructed. It is divinely constructed. However, the tools of AI can be useful, particularly when viewed from the creation-fall-redemption perspective. God has indeed placed good gifts into every community. While sin has brought enormous brokenness, Christ has been sustaining all of creation, including culture, since the dawn of time, and is in the process of reconciling all of it. Hence, all communities are a mix of good and bad. Christians can use AI to identify the good gifts that God has placed in a community and to dream about how to use those gifts to fix what is wrong, thereby bringing about a greater witness to the realities of the coming kingdom. The AI approach to ABCD asks poor individuals and communities to consider the questions in the four-part process. Discovery. What gives life? Finding the best of what is. Appreciating. Dream. What might be? What is God calling for? Envisioning impact. Dialogue. What should be? The ideal. Co-constructing. Delivery. What is working? How increase it? Sustaining. Some Christian non-government organizations, NGOs, working in the majority world have experienced outstanding results from using AI. For example, Bryant Myers reports that a Christian NGO in Tanzania wanted to stop the dynamic of poor communities presenting the NGO with a laundry list of things they expected the NGO staff to do for them. Wanting the communities to take greater responsibility for their own improvement, the NGO has been using AI with remarkable results. The laundry list of problems the community would like the NGO to fix is lost in the enthusiasm of describing what is already working. The community comes to view its past and itself in a new light. We do know things. We do have resources. We have a lot to be proud of. We are already on the journey. God has been good to us. We can do something. We are not God forsaken. This is a major step toward recovering the community's true identity and discovering its true vocation. With these discoveries, a major transformational frontier has been crossed. It may be difficult for readers to understand how AI can unleash such a powerful process, but that is because most of us do not understand the profound sense of despair and shame that envelops many poor communities around the world. AI can help shift the focus from all that has gone wrong to all that has gone right. AI can also work in the North American context. A church in Florida operated a monthly food pantry in which it handed out boxes of food to needy people who were required, before they could get their food, to listen to a devotional delivered by a person with whom they had no relationship. The church's community ministries director realized the church was simply enabling the recipients to persist in poverty by providing relief when development was the correct intervention. Hence, she decided to use AI to move to a more empowering dynamic. Rather than talking at the recipients of the food, They broke into small groups consisting of a mix of the recipients and the church members. The small groups then used AI to discover the gifts and abilities of the recipients. The community ministries director reports on the effects. Rather than trying to fix them, we are engaging in relationships with them. In the process, we are finding out how impoverished we are and how much we need them in order to see our own spiritual poverty. There is a real spirit of authentic community growing, and more participants are beginning to come to worship. Members are picking people up and bringing them to church, and are working with them on budgeting and finding jobs, and best of all, just enjoying one another as friends. I believe it is ever so slowly changing the culture of our church. We are beginning to look more broken, but beautiful. I guess the words of some of the food pantry participants have been my biggest encouragement that we are heading in the right direction. One lady said, "I no longer feel like I'm just a number in the crowd. Now I have a face." Another said, "Even if I don't need groceries next month, can I still come?" We have begun using participants who come regularly as volunteers, and they are delighted to serve. Last month, one man said, "I feel like we're sort of a church within a church." A volunteer told me that a person he did an exit interview with said that what set our ministry apart from other food pantries was that we treated them with respect, as though we actually enjoyed them. ABCD is not a recipe for success in poverty alleviation. Nothing is. But getting off on the right foot can make a huge difference in unleashing the empowering dynamics that are crucial for fostering reconciliation, poverty alleviation, both in the materially poor and in ourselves. Chapter 6. MIC Development. Over 2.5 billion people not served. Wanting to assist a village in Colombia with its rice production, a nonprofit organization gathered the villagers into a cooperative and brought them a thresher, a motorized hauler, a generator, and a tractor. Rice production boomed, and the cooperative sold the rice at the highest price the farmers had ever received. The project appeared to be a tremendous success. The nonprofit organization then left the village. But several years later, one of its staff members returned to find that the cooperative had completely disbanded, and that all of the equipment was broken down and rusting away in the fields. In fact, some of the equipment had never been used at all. Yet as the staff member walked through the village, the people pleaded with him, "If your organization would just come help us again, we could do so much." The sad truth is that this story is extremely common. All around the world, one can find donated equipment that is rusting away, latrines that have never been used, community associations that have disbanded, and projects that disintegrated soon after the nonprofit organization left town. Despite an estimated $2.3 trillion in foreign aid dispensed from Western nations during the post-World War II era, more than 2.5 billion people, approximately 40% of the world's population, still live on less than $2 per day. And the story in many North American communities is similar, with one initiative after another failing to meet its intended objectives. Indeed, 45 years after President Johnson launched the War on Poverty, the poverty rate in America stubbornly hovers around 12%, decade after decade, year after year. Yes, there has been progress in the global fight against poverty, but the bang for the buck has been appallingly low. There are a lot of machines rusting away in fields. Why? Learning process versus blueprint approaches. This book has already explained a number of reasons for the slow progress in poverty alleviation. But another reason needs to be highlighted: inadequate participation of poor people in the process. Researchers and practitioners have found that meaningful inclusion of poor people in the selection, design, implementation, and evaluation of an intervention increases the likelihood of that intervention's success. Unfortunately, the majority of post-World War II approaches to poverty alleviation have been highly non-participatory, using a blueprint approach in which the economically non-poor make all the decisions about the project and then do the project to the economically poor. The ultimate goal of the blueprint approach is often to develop a standardized product and then to roll out that product in cookie-cutter fashion on a massive scale. It's McDevelopment, the fast food franchise approach to poverty alleviation, and it has resulted in more than 2.5 billion poor people not being well served. Although the blueprint approach appears to be very efficient, it often fails because it imposes solutions on poor communities that are inconsistent with local culture, that are not embraced and owned by the community members, or that cannot work in that particular setting. The fact that the equipment worked well in Kansas simply does not mean it will work well in the cultural, economic, and institutional context of sub-Saharan Africa. We're not in Kansas anymore. For example, the staff worker of a nonprofit organization working in a Latin American country describes how the non-participatory approach of a short-term mission team resulted in a house being built that may soon go unused. One team came in here to build the house of a low-income pastor of a local church. In the design of the house, the team put the bathroom in the middle of the house, which runs counter to local culture, in which bathrooms are located in the back of the house. The pastor had not seen the plans of the house in advance. When he discovered this mistake while the team was building the house, he objected to the team leaders to no avail. The short-term team felt happy that they gave the pastor a much-needed house. But the pastor is ashamed of his house and is not sure he wants to live in it. And the cultural barriers are there on our own soil in places we might not even anticipate. Consider the Farmers Home Administration, FMHA program, that attempted to provide housing loans for poor people in the rural southern United States. The FMHA specified that every house in the program would be standardized, having carpets on the floors and small kitchens that included washing machines. Research on the program's efficacy found the following. The FMHA's specifications for how houses may be built actually defy community wisdom and experience. Many applicants for housing loans consider it unsanitary to cook and wash laundry in the same room. They know that overflowing, second-hand washing machines are best located in a storage or utility room outside the house. They know that there are other advantages to putting the washers outside. You can take off your work clothes before you go into the house, and your clean laundry is closer to the clothesline. People who live on dirt roads, who work the land, and who are employed in poultry processing plants or in lint-filled mills often prefer vinyl floors that can be swept. But they can't have them in this program. Because of these types of pitfalls, many practitioners have abandoned the blueprint model in favor of a learning process approach to development, an approach that seeks to facilitate an action-reflection cycle in which poor people participate in all aspects of the project, proposing the best course of action, implementing the chosen strategy, evaluating how well things are working, and determining the appropriate modifications. The role of the outsider in this approach is not to do something to or for the economically poor individual or community, but to seek solutions together with them. A learning process approach increases the likelihood that the project will work well for two main reasons. First, like all human beings, poor people are more likely to have a sense of enthusiasm for and ownership of a project if they have been full participants in it from the very beginning. When the project is theirs, they are more likely to sacrifice to make it work well and to sustain it over the long haul. Second, poor individuals and communities are highly complex and not well understood by the materially non-poor. Hence, the knowledge and skills of the insiders, the materially poor themselves, are vital to getting things done and to making things work well. People living in North American ghettos, in Appalachia, in slums in Mexico City, and in rural India really do know a lot of things about those contexts that outsiders will never understand. It is simply foolish to ignore their insights. Ironically, while a learning process approach typically takes more time to produce tangible results than a blueprint approach, the learning process approach is often more efficient in the long run because it is more likely to result in workable and sustainable interventions. Put another way, participation can reduce the likelihood of unused equipment rusting away in the fields. Not just a means, but an end. While it is good when the equipment is used and the rice output increases, viewing participation solely as a means of achieving those ends misses the fundamental reason that participation is so vital to poverty alleviation. Participation is not just the means to an end, but rather a legitimate end in its own right. Why? It all goes back to the definition of poverty alleviation. Remember, the goal is to restore people to experiencing humanness in the way that God intended. The crucial thing is to help people to understand their identity as image bearers, to love their neighbors as themselves, to be stewards over God's creation, and to bring glory to God in all things. One of the many manifestations of such holistic reconciliation is that people exercise dominion over their individual lives and communities, constantly seeking better ways to use their gifts and resources to solve problems and to create bounty in service to God and others. Thus, the goal is not just that the equipment gets used and that rice output goes up, but rather that poor people are empowered to make decisions about the best way to farm, to act upon their decisions, to evaluate the results of their decisions, and then to start the decision-making process all over again. Hence, participation in its fullest sense is not just a means to an end, but the most important end. It is impossible to accomplish such reconciliation of relationships in a blueprint approach in which the outsiders are the ones deciding what to do, how to do it, and how well it worked. Such an approach undermines the action-reflection cycle for poor people, denying them the opportunity to be what God created them to be, image bearers who, through trial and error, unpack and unfold the wonders of God's creation. Furthermore, the blueprint approach implicitly communicates, I, the outsider, am superior. You are inferior. I am here to fix you. A participatory approach, in contrast, asks the poor at each step in the process, what do you think? Then really values the answers that are given. The very fact that the question is being asked is a powerful statement that says, I believe you have value, knowledge, and insights. You know things about your situation that I do not know. Please share some of your insights with me. Let us learn together. we saw an excellent example of a ministry using a learning process approach, both as a means and an end, in developing an entire community. Recall from Chapter 3 that Mark Gornick and Alan and Susan Tibbles moved into inner-city Baltimore and then worked with the community residents, using a participatory process that took 4 years to produce a single house. This participatory process created the energy and ownership that eventually led to the rehabilitation of hundreds of homes in the subsequent years. But these homes were the byproduct of the central goal: getting community members to participate more fully in all that it means to be human. A learning process can also be used when ministering to individuals one-on-one. For example, the director of a home and ministry for single mothers in Knoxville, Tennessee, describes his ministry's approach as follows. Instead of having a one-size-fits-all blueprint for each family, our ministry tries to journey alongside a single mother and her children, believing that the family's unique strengths, history, and future goals need to be understood and appreciated. The mother meets weekly with a family advocate who helps her begin to explore the areas of her family's life that are in need of restoration. While the family advocate facilitates the process, each single mother participates in the process by working to envision the family's future and setting goals and initiating the action steps necessary to achieve them. The family advocate is then able to help hold the mother accountable, as well as contribute to the family's long-term plan through resource development. The single mothers in this program desire to someday purchase their own homes and to be self-sufficient. But the very fact that these mothers are dreaming, planning, and striving toward that end is a major success in its own right. A cautionary word. A word of caution is in order. Secular arguments for participation often rest on two faulty assumptions. First, given the postmodern belief that truth is relative, some argue that poor people must participate in the process because they need to construct their own reality. Who are we, outsiders, to impose our ideas on poor people, they say. Second, a humanist faith in the inherent goodness of human beings leads some to believe that participation, like democracy, will necessarily produce positive results. Both of these assumptions are wrong from a biblical perspective. The Bible clearly teaches that there is absolute truth, and that, to the extent that we know it, we are to speak such truth in love. Ephesians chapter 4, verse 15. Moreover, all of us, including poor people, are sinful. Participation does not have the capacity to overcome the basic corruption in the human condition. Individuals and groups make bad decisions all the time. However, a participatory approach is consistent with a biblical perspective concerning poverty and its alleviation. The scriptural truths that all of us are broken and that all of us retain the image of God are affirmed by a process that solicits and values the positive contributions of everyone, both insiders and outsiders. Furthermore, the fact that participatory approaches enable the materially poor to teach the materially non-poor helps to overcome the inferior-superior dynamic that typically characterizes the interactions between them. As a result, the dignity of the materially poor is affirmed, and the God complexes of the materially non-poor are dispelled. Types of participation. There is a continuum of different levels of participation that are observed in practice. Approaches move from doing things to poor people, a blueprint approach, toward doing things with poor people, a learning process approach. When the poor have been completely empowered, they are in the community-initiated category, in which the projects are being directed by the poor themselves, and they determine the role of any outsiders in their initiatives. Unfortunately, the top-down blueprint methods that are typically used in poverty alleviation make the community-initiated mode of participation a rarity. But both the existing literature and our own experiences demonstrate that achieving this mode is not impossible. There is not a one-size-fits-all level of participation that is best for all churches, missionaries, and ministries in all settings. The appropriate nature and degree of participation depends on a host of contextual factors, including the mission of the organization, the type of intervention being considered, and the capacity and culture of the poor people involved. It takes wisdom to discern the best type and level of participation in each setting. That having been said, outsiders should normally seek to foster the cooperation, or better yet, co-learning modes of participation in hopes of achieving the community-initiated level, the point at which the outsiders are no longer the key players. Christians rightly understand that the church is the, 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 15 says, pillar and foundation of the truth, and that unbelievers are people who, Romans chapter 1, verse 18 says, suppress the truth by their wickedness. By the grace of God alone, we really do have knowledge that unbelievers do not have. Unfortunately, this reality can create not just an unwarranted sense of pride in spiritual matters, but also a sense of condescension toward unbelievers in all matters. We are often know-it-alls in situations in which we really do not know more. Naturally, it would be ludicrous to let an unbeliever determine the best way to administer the sacraments just because we want to use participatory methods. We really do know more about the right way to do this than they do. At the same time, it would be equally ludicrous to assume that we know more than an unbeliever in Thailand about the best way to plant rice in his country. As image bearers, unbelievers often have a lot of good ideas. To deny this is an affront to the one whose image they bear. And many times, those we seek to help are fellow believers who have important spiritual insights to teach us. Seek the highest level of participation possible in each situation. Giving voice to the voiceless. In many poor communities, there is considerable diversity in terms of ethnicity, race, gender, age, religion, and socioeconomic status. Hence, it is important to make sure that each group has meaningful participation, both because each group may bring a unique perspective, and because participation is an important goal in its own right. In particular, it is vital to give a voice to the voiceless by looking for ways to make it safe for those on the margins to express their views throughout the process. As mentioned in Chapter 5, one of the central methods that can be used to engage a community is participatory learning and action, PLA, a mindset and associated set of tools that enable an outsider to facilitate a learning process in poor communities. PLA engages people, creating a safe and fun way for them to share their knowledge and to construct their own solutions to the problems they are facing. It is important to engage a diversity of perspectives in PLA. In a rural Paraguayan village, men and women from the same village were separately asked to draw maps of that village and to note on the maps the frequency with which they visited each spot. The men and women had quite different perceptions of their community. It appeared that men are from Mars and women are from Venus, in Paraguay, too. A failure to include multiple voices in the PLA process would have caused everyone involved to have a distorted view of how the community as a whole viewed itself. Donor alert.
It has become commonplace in charitable giving to ask,
what is the most highly leveraged way to invest money in order to have the greatest impact for the kingdom? The question is legitimate, and it often reflects a godly desire to steward the Lord's resources faithfully. However, donors need to remember that reconciling people's relationships with God, self, others, and the rest of creation is simply not the same as producing and selling widgets. Deep and lasting change takes time. In fact, fully engaging the poor in a participatory process takes lots of time. But if donors do not want the equipment to rust in the fields, they are going to have to accept a slower process, a process in which the poor are empowered to decide whether or not they even want the equipment in the first place. It might help donors if they remembered that creating decision-making capacity on the part of the poor is a return, arguably the chief return, on their investment. The following section describes what really happened when the Chalmers Center for Economic Development, the research and training center for which Steve and I work, was asked to help with the tsunami recovery in Indonesia. The rest of the story. 4 months after the tsunami hit, a Christian relief and development organization working in Indonesia asked the Chalmers Center for help in designing a small business recovery program. We sent 2 young staff members to the region and provided technical backup support to them from our home office in the United States. We share this story not to show you how smart we are, our failures outnumber our successes, but because we believe the story illustrates many of the principles presented in this book. In considering whether or not to accept this request to work in Indonesia, we were greatly influenced by the fact that a well-respected relief and development organization on the ground was requesting our help. This organization had an outstanding track record of soliciting input from the local people, so we knew from the outset that our presence was in response to the wishes of the community and not something we were forcing on them. While such a participatory approach is always important, it was particularly crucial in this case because this militant Muslim region was notorious for its hostility to outsiders in general and to Christians in particular. The region had been devastated, but the downward spiral had stopped for the most part. Hence, rehabilitation and development, not relief, were the appropriate next steps. In an attempt to identify the relevant local assets and the most significant obstacles, our staff interviewed and consulted with the local leaders of 10 small business associations, individual business owners, and the mayor, discovering the following. They had a strong history of people using their own savings for business capital. And, in contrast to most settings in the majority world, a remarkable bank had a history of providing savings and loan services to very poor people, and it was well trusted. Unfortunately, the bank's offices had been severely damaged, and it was low on loan capital. And business in the region were organized into strong guilds or organized by the type of business, a baker's guild, a carpenter's guild, a rickshaw guild, etc. And the mayor had an attitude of wanting to work with these guilds and with the Christian Relief and Development Organization. And there was a strong sense of community spirit exhibited in Gotong Royong, a practice of coming together as a group to solve problems, not unlike an Amish barn raising. And local labor was in abundance, as many had lost their livelihoods. And local construction firms existed, but had been damaged by the tsunami. And a lack of capital was identified as the primary obstacle to restarting the small businesses. The obvious solution in such a situation would be to bring in construction crews to rebuild the businesses' shops and to set up a micro-enterprise development program to lend money to these businesses, right? Wrong. This approach might undermine the local construction firms, the culture of savings, the remarkable bank, local knowledge and authority, and community spirit. While the level of devastation did require outside resources to restore the city and these businesses to their pre-tsunami conditions, the trick was to introduce such resources without undermining the assets that had been identified and the stewardship abilities of the Indonesian people. In particular, how could business capital be introduced quickly without undermining the culture of savings and the local bank? Toward that end, it was decided that phase one of the program would involve giving mini-grants of capital to small business owners to enable them to restart their businesses. However, receiving such grants was conditional upon the business owners presenting evidence of having had a small business before the tsunami, of opening a savings account with the local bank, and of participating in a gotong royong to clean up buildings and streets, including the office of the local bank. The evidence presented was reviewed by a committee of leaders from the guilds and local government. By design, the first grants were given to the local construction firms so that they, not outsiders, could rebuild the devastated buildings and homes, thereby re-establishing their construction businesses. Phase one also included a short series of small business training sessions for the low-income entrepreneurs. These lessons included important technical material and related biblical principles. Thus, Muslim small business owners received an exposure to the scriptures in a practical way. As discussed in Chapter 3, poverty alleviation efforts often need to address both broken systems and individuals, including a clear articulation of the gospel and a biblical worldview. Phase 2 began 8 weeks after Phase 1 and consisted primarily of a matched savings program to provide additional business capital while encouraging local savings and the reestablishment of the bank. Recipients of the mini-grants in Phase 1 again had to present evidence of a consistent pattern of savings over the 8 weeks to the local review committee. Each individual's savings were then matched with outside funds at a 2-to-1 ratio, with the matching funds being placed into their savings accounts at the bank. Another series of small business training classes incorporating a Christian worldview was offered. As with any program, there were ups and downs, but the overall success was significant. Hundreds of businesses received assistance. Local institutions were strengthened, and the midterm project evaluations indicated improvements in people's relationships with God, self, others, and the rest of creation. Moreover, the highly participatory approach enabled the Christian Relief and Development Organization to establish a great deal of trust with the normally suspicious Indonesians, resulting in the organization being able to expand the small business recovery program in other parts of Indonesia. Even a major secular international humanitarian organization was impressed with the results and invited the Christian organization to submit a grant proposal for funding to scale up the program. The principles outlined in this book are not a magic formula for success, but they are powerful, and they have been used by God in even extremely difficult settings that are quite hostile to the gospel. Part 3. Practical Strategies for Helping Without Hurting. Chapter 7. Doing Short-Term Missions Without Doing Long-Term Harm. There were 120,000 in 1989, 450,000 in 1998, 1 million in 2003, and 2,200,000 in 2006. The numbers reflect a tsunami of epic proportions, a tidal wave of American short-term missionaries flooding the world. The cost? Americans spent $1.6 billion on short-term missions, STMs, in 2006 alone. The phenomenal growth of STMs over the past decade is accompanied or fueled by much positive press. Reports claim that STMs accomplish much in the host community and have a positive impact on those who go, especially in terms of their becoming further engaged in missions through giving and becoming long-term missionaries. While there may be some truth in these reports, a different storyline is also emerging, one that is questioning whether STMs are as good as advertised. For example, missions expert Miriam Adonai relates a story told to her by an African Christian friend. Elephant and Mouse were best friends. One day, Elephant said, "Mouse, let's have a party." Animals gathered from far and near. They ate, they drank, they sang, and they danced. And nobody celebrated more and danced harder than Elephant. After the party was over, Elephant exclaimed, "Mouse, did you ever go to a better party? What a blast!" But Mouse did not answer. "Mouse, where are you?" Elephant called. He looked around for his friend, and then shrank back in horror. There, at Elephant's feet, lay Mouse. His little body was ground into the dirt. He had been smashed by the big feet of his exuberant friend, Elephant. "Sometimes that is what it is like to do mission with you Americans," the African storyteller commented. "It is like dancing with an elephant." Elephant did not mean to do harm, but he did not understand the effects he was having on Mouse. The same can be true for many STM trips, particularly those to poor communities. The term short-term missions refers to trips ranging from 1 week to 2 years, either to locations within North America or around the world. The focus of this chapter will be on trips of 2 weeks or less, the length experienced by more than 50% of the 2.2 million STM participants from the United States in 2006. However, many of the issues discussed also apply to longer STMs. In addition, this chapter will pay particular attention to STMs that seek to minister to the physical needs of materially poor people, whether they are at home or abroad. We will then examine the wisdom of STMs from the perspective of stewardship and conclude the chapter with suggestions for improving the STM experience for everyone. However, we first lay the background for the entire discussion with a quick introduction to some important cross-cultural issues. Cross-cultural engagement 101. One of the reasons that STM teams sometimes dance like Elephant is that the teams are unaware of what happens when cultures collide. The focus here is not on such cultural differences as dress, food, architecture, art, etc., but rather on the differences in the value systems that silently drive people to respond in predictable patterns. These value systems involve quite a range of things, including people's view of who or what is in control of their lives, of the nature of risk and uncertainty, of the organization and role of authority, of the nature of time, and of the role of individuals versus groups. Space only permits a discussion of the last two factors just mentioned. Cultures around the world exhibit contrasting views of how time operates. The monochronic view sees time as a limited and valuable resource. Time can be lost or saved. Good stewardship of time means getting the most out of every minute. The favorite monochronic proverb is, "Time is money." Daytimers are important tools for success. The biblical injunction to redeem the time brings visions of to-do lists being completed day after day. A second perspective of time is the polychronic view. In this understanding, time is a somewhat unlimited resource. There is always more time. Schedules and plans are mere guidelines that have little authority in shaping how one spends one's day. Tasks typically take a back seat to forming and deepening relationships. While fewer goods and services might get produced in a polychronic culture, people in such cultures often have a deeper sense of community and belonging. Various countries fit on the monochronic, polychronic continuum. The United States is an extreme monochronic culture, whereas nations in the majority world are strongly polychronic. Many low-income African American and Hispanic communities in North America would also be more polychronic than middle to upper-class North American churches and people are. Similarly, cultures differ in their understanding of the role of the individual and the group in shaping life. On the one hand, there are individualistic cultures, which focus on the intrinsic value and uniqueness of each human being, and exhibit the egalitarian perspective that all people should be treated equally as much as possible. People in individualistic cultures are taught to strive to be all that they can be in terms of personal achievement. Being employee of the month and most valuable player on the team are seen as positive and motivating awards. Churches in such cultures stress one's personal calling and conduct inventories of spiritual gifts and personality tests. Collectivist cultures, on the other hand, minimize individual identity and focus on the well-being of the group. Loyalty to and self-sacrifice for the sake of other group members are seen as virtuous. People in